With the Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, no, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Everyone, and welcome to another edition of the MMA Torch podcast. It is Thursday, April 28th, 2016. I am MMA Torch editor Jamie Pennock, joined tonight by MMA Torch senior columnist Sean Ennis. Sean, it is NFL draft night. Your team picked Carson Wentz second overall tonight. I'm sure you're real thrilled about Division II football being at the helm of your team this year, but
I couldn't be more optimistic.
They're trotting out a whole bunch of kids in Bears outfits on TV right now for Rich's team's pick in number 9. To give you some time frame as to when this is being recorded, we are coming off of UFC 197 last weekend, and Jon Jones back into action for the first time since January of 2015, taking on Ovince St. Preux on short notice after Daniel Cormier dropped out of the event with an injury. Sean, before we get into the full-on fight-by-fight breakdown here, because there's a lot to talk about, just overall thoughts on the event itself and how it came off to you, given the loss of that main event.
It was pretty pedestrian. I mean, there was a lot of fun stuff on it, but it wasn't necessarily, it wasn't a fantastic card. Wasn't a terrible card. Wasn't bad at all. It was fine. Nothing, outside of the Yair Rodriguez knockout, which we'll get to, I'm sure. Nothing really stood out all that much.
Jones in the main event, he was in a tough spot here into this card.
Yeah.
It's the first time that he took a short notice fight, and I think it's pretty clear why he doesn't normally take short notice fights at the end of it.
Yeah.
And that's while he was still the dominant, clear winner of the fight, which I think says as much about Jon Jones as anything else. This was Ovince St. Preux was a dangerous fighter, given the stylistic matchup here. I think Jones could have done himself some favors by trying to commit to the takedown a lot more than he did, because when he had the fight on the ground in the fourth round, it was far and away his best round. But even with that said, Jones was safe yet highly effective. He was picking spots. He was still throwing spinning kicks, spinning wheel kicks, elbows, punches. The oblique kicks did tons of damage. He broke Ovince St. Preux's arm in the second round. I mean, he was still, while it came off as a bit tentative, a bit safe, still doing a ton in this fight. And I think too much of it got overlooked by the fact that he didn't just smoke Ovince St. Preux.
Yeah, that's the kind of the funny thing about this fight and about Jon Jones in general is that he can hurt you immediately, and he can continue to hurt you slowly over the course of five rounds, like he did against Ovince St. Preux and against Glover Teixeira, for that matter. This really reminded me a lot of the Teixeira match. Although, you know, Jones didn't, Jones could have gone into a finishing sequence at any given time, you know, especially later in the fight, like you said, I think the fourth round, where he almost stopped that fight at the end of the round, and probably would have had there been another, you know, 15, 20 seconds left in the round, but He can tend to dominate his opponent over the course of five rounds, but when you talk about guys that dominate their opponents over the course of five rounds, you're not typically thinking of guys who injure their opponents early. Like in this one, like you said, he broke his arm early, and against Glover Teixeira, he pretty much ripped his arm out of the socket in the first round, you know, and just continues to punish them throughout the course of the fight, but doesn't, you know, he's not a one-punch guy. He's not a guy who's going to come in there and put you out of action, you know, quickly with a big, you know, a big shot or something like that. And, you know, unless he decides to go for a submission or go into, you know, just some vicious ground and pound, he has the propensity to just cause damage, like heavy damage throughout the course of a fight, even without stopping it. That's what he did here.
Yeah, and I mean, those oblique kicks took their toll. He was just messing up Ovince's legs throughout the fight. And at the same time, I can't fault him for playing it safe. And he talked about it after the fight, where really in his mind it was about, you have to get to DC. You have to get to the Daniel Cormier fight. He stepped up to not have another one of his events marred by cancellation or him not taking another fight. And, you know, he stepped up and did the favor this time around, but he had no incentive to do anything more than he did. And I don't think there's anything wrong with his performance, and I don't think it's a sign of anything negative with John Jones either. In fact, I take it more as a, okay, if there was any residual rust, which I'm not convinced was the case here, he's shaking it off, and now he's ready for Daniel Cormier in a few months, which we'll get to that aspect of it shortly.
I think that pretty much puts it pretty succinctly there. There was no reason for him, like, there was more of a reason for him to be in there longer than to go in there and just blitz OSP and take him out early.
Well, and the other aspect of this that just gets underappreciated is how intelligent Jones is at breaking down fights.
Yeah.
And him and his team and what they do in breaking down what they want to do against their opponents. Because he spent months and months and months working on Daniel Cormier and got a curveball thrown with a completely different style of fighter in St. Preux. Yes, he was better. He was going to be the better fighter before and after the fight. It was very unlikely St. Preux was going to do anything to change that in this fight. But even still, it's a very different stylistic matchup. It's a very different type of opponent. St. Preux's got very heavy hands and stopping power, even though Jones has a very good chin, and he showed that off on Saturday. You still don't want to risk it with taking too many unnecessary shots. And a guy like St. Preux is capable of delivering that type of power at any time in a fight. Jones came into this not having put together the game plan to dismantle Ovince St. Preux, and yet he did it anyway. So, yeah. He, more prepared against the opponent he was planning to fight, we get a different John Jones on Saturday night, and I'll let you comment on that before I get to the next point with DC, which pertains to that aspect of things.
I missed you just for a second there. What was I commenting on?
Just John Jones and the game planning aspect of the opponent switch.
Yeah, and that's kind of I think that speaks to his camp as well. You know, there was a lot made of the things that were said in his corner, and, you know, working with Greg Jackson, you know, you can tell that John Jones takes instruction well, which is kind of funny given the kind of guy he is outside the cage. He is able. The thing is, you know, a lot of guys have to prepare for a lot longer to take on different kinds of opponents. You know, you can have a game plan on paper, you know, within a day or so, but John Jones is good enough that he can implement that game plan on what seems like a moment's notice and just be dominant against the guy. You know, still, we all pretty much figured how this fight was going to go, at least who was going to win it. But this is still a top 10 light heavyweight we're talking about here. So, you know, just that's the kind of thing that just puts Jones on another stratosphere from other guys.
As an aside, before I get to the DC aspect of it, since Rich isn't here to send things off the rails, I figured we'd comment on his not meltdown yet, but certain disappointment in the Bears pick at number 9 in the NFL draft. The Chicago Bears took Georgia linebacker Leonard Floyd in the first round. Rich had one word in his response.
What would that word be?
Can you guess?
Does it begin with an F?
It absolutely does. Back to Saturday night. Daniel Cormier was on commentary during this fight. And afterward was visibly upset and wrote down on his notes while watching that it was a missed opportunity. Cormier was upset that he didn't get to fight what he perceived to be a lesser John Jones. And part of me gets it, because obviously he just wanted the win. He wanted the win. He wants the win by any means necessary, but it's not a good look for Daniel Cormier to be lamenting not being able to fight a rusty and quote unquote less than John Jones.
Yeah, it kind of is a really bad look, quite honestly, because it seemed like he was really disappointed. Like, he wasn't saying this like tongue in cheek, like, oh boy, if I'd have had him tonight, that'd have been it for him. He seemed like really upset and disappointed that he didn't get to fight this fight. And it's kind of funny to me. You know, I said a while back, I think on one of the shows, that John Jones has taken up permanent residence in Daniel Cormier's head, and this just further demonstrates that. You know, I feel like Cormier doesn't, you know, all athletes, and especially all high-level athletes, are confident, you know, really confident guys, and justifiably so. But I get the feeling that Cormier, deep down, doesn't think he can beat John Jones, and thinks that he missed out on his opportunity to get that win back tonight, or on Saturday.
Yeah, I mean, I think it certainly comes off as if he felt he could win that fight and knew he wouldn't in a rubber match.
Yeah.
And that's the missed opportunity, because it would have set up an immediate third fight, and that trilogy bout would have been huge. Instead, now they're fighting at UFC 200, and I don't see any reason to believe that fight ends in anything other than John Jones with his hand raised.
Yeah. And probably similar scores, 50-45, 50-44.
Honestly, I would be surprised if it goes the distance this time around.
I was just going to say, if it's not a stoppage.
I will give Cormier credit for this. While sitting next to Rogan and Goldberg, he cut what is the best promo he has ever cut on Jones. And I almost got behind him on this, because I liked the way that he did this. And this came after Jones walked out of the cage, looked over to Cormier, cage side, waited till he got his attention, then flipped him the bird and walked out to the back. This was also before UFC 200 was officially announced for those two, but it was 2 days later. But this is what Cormier had to say. I'll be there with my championship belt, with my red wraps on my gloves, as I come out second and you wait for me to walk to the octagon. We meet here live from the T-Mobile Arena, brand new arena out here in Las Vegas, and we unify these titles. Don't bring that interim belt. You leave that at home. That's garbage. That's a play belt. They got that thing from the kiosk upstairs before they gave it to you in the middle of the octagon. Leave that thing at home, John. Come chase this real title. Get beat, and I'll ship you back to Albuquerque. The best thing Daniel Cormier has ever said publicly.
That's true.
Of course, John Jones then brought his belt to Madison Square Garden and said, "You have the interim belt. This is the real belt that I won from Shogun." And there's that.
There's not much he can say to dispute that.
Yeah. It's a rough spot for Cormier, because he's got to say whatever he has to say to himself to put him in the mindset that he belongs where he's at. because the simple reality is that's not the real belt.
Yeah.
They can repeat it ad nauseum. That's not the real sign of who the best in the division is right now. And
yeah.
I mean, Jones. I'll go through Jones's comments from MSG in the press conference they had this week. DC should have a lot of confidence. Outside of me, he's the next best thing. He can beat these other guys. He can't beat me. I don't believe greatness is coincidence, and I don't believe DC is great. If he was great, he would have beaten Kale Sanderson in college. If he was great, he would have made weight in the Olympics. If he was great, he would have beaten me the first time. I've never lost a fight, so let him be confident. He can beat these other guys all day. He's not beating me.
Yeah. That pretty much sums it up, doesn't it?
It's a cold line about the Olympics, especially.
Yeah, but ice cold.
Also, not unfair, relevant, accurate, and just the simple reality of their two situations. And not only that, but when they squared off after that press conference, I swear it looked like Jones had gained 6 inches.
Yeah.
There's such a size disparity between the two fighters. There is a simple raw talent disparity between the two fighters because Jones is one of the singularly most talented fighters in this sport. Just from the physical tools that he has and the natural abilities that he has in line with what he does technically. And then on top of that, he's gotten perhaps stronger in his time off. I just, Daniel Cormier said that he wants to take Jones down and hold him there for 25 minutes at UFC 200, except Jones then rightfully pointed out that it's 5-0 on the takedowns, and it's not in favor of DC between the two of them. So I don't see a path to victory for Daniel Cormier against Jon Jones.
No,
I didn't in the UFC 182, and that fight only solidified the difference between the two fighters. Daniel Cormier is a great fighter. He is not better than Jon Jones. I don't think he's better than Jon Jones on Jones's worst day.
Yeah, I agree. And, you know, the shame of it is, if Daniel Cormier had come along at a different time, he probably would have dominated the light heavyweight division for, you know, as long as he wanted to. But Jon Jones, man, he is one of those transcendent guys. He's a guy that comes along once in a generation. You know, you don't see guys like this every day. He's the physical tools that he has, combined with the fight IQ that he has and the ability to do crazy things on a moment's notice, just puts him on a level where nobody else is. So I don't see how Daniel Cormier is going to win this fight. Everything that Daniel Cormier does, Jon Jones does better and does a lot better. So I don't know. I mean, especially
Jones also does a lot more that Cormier doesn't do.
Exactly. And I don't see, you know, Cormier's only path to victory would be, like he said, to take him down and hold him down for 25 minutes. And that, I don't see that as being a remote possibility.
No, there's no possible way that comes to fruition.
Yeah.
Let's keep the topic of technical proficiency going here, because Demetrius Mighty Mouse Johnson looked incredible against Henry Cejudo on Saturday night. He got taken down by the Olympic gold medalist, and then he proceeded to not take any damage and immediately kick him off to get to his feet. And Demetrius Johnson showcased one of the most underrated or underappreciated aspects of his game in this fight. And that's
that clinch game, man.
That's his tie clinch. Oh, man. That brutal clinch was incredible. And as Cejudo said, that was his game plan, was to work in the clinch. He thought he could outwork Johnson in the clinch. Instead, he got hit from every angle by knees, elbows, knees again, more knees. More punches, more knees. Every time he blocked somewhere, he was getting hit to the other side. Johnson kept switching up where he was attacking to the point that Cejudo could only crumple up. Yeah. He took a couple of nasty knees to the body, and this was over in 2 minutes and 50 seconds. This was a previously undefeated fighter who had gone the distance against pretty much everyone he had fought in the UFC. And not pretty much, I think it was everyone he had fought in the UFC. And who had been very solid. I mean, not great, but very good. And Johnson made quick work of him, continued to prove that there is no one at 125 pounds right now really capable of competing with him. We might find out that Joseph Benavidez is in a rematch if that's what happens next, and it's what should happen next.
Yeah.
But clearly, Mighty Mouse Johnson is something different entirely in 2016 than he was even 4 years ago. You know, he's 4.5 years removed from the loss to Dominic Cruz for the bantamweight title. And even in the first couple of fights at flyweight, you know, the first fight with Ian McCall was unspectacular, ended in that draw. They needed the rematch. He looked a lot better in that rematch. He looked good but not great in the first Benavidez fight. Since then, there's been a complete change, and that's been facilitated by the fact that he was finally making the type of money that allowed him to train full-time and focus solely on becoming a better fighter, and he has done so in spades. There's been an exponential growth for Demetrius Johnson over the last 4 years.
Yeah, no one has been remotely competitive with him since John Dodson hurt him in the second round of their first fight. No one can touch him. And it's pretty remarkable. I mean, the only thing I wish about his situation is that the flyweight division were deeper and more of a known commodity. You know, I feel like he gets a little bit shortchanged, not because he fights at 125, you know, because of the size thing, but more because of the age of the division and the we know that Joseph Benavidez is good. We know that John Dodson is good. The rest of these guys, you know, you get defenses in there against Chris Carriazo, you get Kyoji Horiguchi. You know, they're solid fighters, but they don't have kind of the pedigree that some of the other divisions have. You know, some of the other divisions that have these guys that are 4, 5, and 6 deep, where, you know, they've been around for several years and they're kind of known commodities. You don't have that same thing at flyweight. So even though Johnson is in there doing terrible things to excellent fighters, you know, I don't feel like he gets the same kind of credit for it because of the depth of the division, which is too bad.
Well, and that goes to the conversation that came out of the event and the regarding the pound for pound status of both Johnson and John Jones. Johnson has a much more compelling case in 2016 than he has at any other point in his career.
Yeah.
For that top spot, I still have him below John Jones strictly
Agreed.
Because of the level of competition.
Yeah.
Because Johnson's been as technically sound as any other fighter, and he's been dominant, and he's been fantastic to watch, and I think that he could compete with anyone at bantamweight right now. I think he's that much better than he was when he fought Dominic Cruz the first time. I don't think that rematch is close to an identical fight.
Right.
But he's fighting guys who really don't have any business fighting for a title, and it's strictly because of where the division's at. Chris
exactly.
Carriazo was not a title challenge, a title-worthy challenger. Kyoji Horiguchi, it was way too soon for him.
Yep.
Henry Cejudo, way too soon for
yep.
him. You know, it's, and I get it. Johnson can't just fight Joseph Benavidez and John Dodson for the rest of his life. I get that. But he's also picking off fighters not on his level. And he's, to his credit, he's absolutely doing what he needs to do and what he should be doing against these fighters. But they're not on his level.
Yeah, and that's kind of the situation that he finds himself in. You know, I mean, you can only fight the guys that are put in front of you, and he's blowing the doors off of guys that he should blow the doors off of, and that's all you can ask of an elite fighter. That's what he's doing. Yeah. But as you said, you know, when you're talking about a pound for pound situation, I don't think it's I don't really think it's much of a debate that John Jones is number one, with Johnson being number two.
Yeah, I mean, and for years it was Jose Aldo right in that conversation. Yep. until he got beat, and Conor McGregor would be right there had he beaten Nate Diaz.
Yep.
But the fact that both Aldo and McGregor lost makes it a very clear one, a very clear two.
Yeah, and I have to think that we're going to get more light shed on this pound-for-pound situation, as much as you can anyway, as the years go by. I mean, both of these guys are still pretty young, and I imagine John Jones is going to be going to a heavyweight and wrecking shop up there. I imagine Johnson will probably defend the title as many times as he can against Joseph Benavidez, and then go to 135 and see what he can do at that point. So, you know, obviously the pound-for-pound thing is always kind of a nebulous situation anyway, but I think we should get some answers as to how they would fare at different weights, maybe even sooner rather than later. Maybe Johnson goes for the record first and then goes up to 135, I don't know, but it'll be interesting to see what happens. I mean, they're both still in their late 20s, so it's good stuff.
As to a fighter leaving nothing but questions, it's hard to know where to start with Anthony Pettis. Edson Barbosa had a very good performance on Saturday night in keeping Pettis off his game, if that's what it was, or I don't know if it was Barbosa entirely keeping Pettis at bay, or if it was Pettis being so gun-shy that he just didn't take advantage of anything given to him. This was a weird fight in that respect, because it's one thing for Pettis to have been tentative and unsure against Rafael Dos Anjos and Eddie Alvarez and hesitant to just throw when you've got grapplers trying to take you down, clinch up, make it hard on you. Instead, he got what was supposed to be a showcase-style matchup, striker versus striker, and he got beat to the punch more often than not, or got beat to the kick more often than not. The inside of his left thigh was just as nasty as it gets from leg kicks.
Yeah.
I don't want to shortchange Barbosa here. I really don't, because he had as good of a performance as we've seen from him in the octagon, perhaps ever. This was a very technically sound Edson Barbosa. He didn't leave himself open for counters. He was countering himself well. He timed a lot of Pettis' attacks, but there's still part of me that sees this as just a real regression from Anthony Pettis, and I don't know if it's strictly mental or if he's just – if something has been irreparably taken from him confidence-wise after the Dos Anjos fight.
Yeah, I think this is where you have to kind of start to ask those questions as to whether RDA stole Pettis' soul, you know, because Edson Barbosa was there on a platter for Anthony Pettis. This is a fight that was given to him to win, make no mistake, because Edson Barbosa, while he is a spectacular striker – is not a guy who's going to try and take you down, which obviously was an issue in Pettis' last couple of fights. And he's a guy who wilts under pressure. You know, when you had – I mean, if you look as far back as Barbosa's first loss to Jamie Varner, you know, who was able to go in there and just once he brought the fight to Barbosa and tagged him a couple of times, it was over. You know, you get him in there against Donald Cerrone, a classic pressure fighter, and what happens? He wilts. He chokes him out in the first round. You get him in there against Michael Johnson. What's that? What happens there? Decision. You get him in there against Tony Ferguson. What happens? Submission. So this was a fight that was tailor-made for Anthony Pettis. If he's going to go forward and attack and doesn't have to worry about getting taken down, this was it, man. This was the one that he was meant to win, and he didn't do it. You know, and like you said, Barbosa went in there and worked his kicks throughout the entire fight. But man, if you go into a fight against Edson Barbosa and don't know that he's going to try and work his kicks, I don't know what to tell you. I mean, this is a guy who's won two fights by leg kicks, or maybe even more than two, three or four maybe. I think three. Three? Yeah. At least three by leg kicks.
Two stoppages by leg kicks.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. That's what I mean. Two stoppages by leg kicks. And you know, you're gonna if you go in there and think that you're not gonna get kicked number one in the leg, number two in the body, which he's also won with body kicks. I don't know what you're thinking, you know. And I'm not, you know, obviously, I'm not a coach, I'm not a fighter, but you know, I could have told you that Edson Barboza was going to be working kicks, you know, and try to keep that distance. And you have to bring the fight to him.
What I thought we were going to see in this one was similar to how Pettis fought against Donald Cerrone and Benson Henderson the second time.
Absolutely. That would have been the way to do it.
Where he was delivering quick body kicks in succession, and he was doing a ton of damage and pressuring. That pressure is what, like you touched on, that pressure aspect against Edson Barboza is where he's vulnerable. And that wasn't there from Pettis. He was tentative. He was hesitant. He was reluctant to engage. And that completely cost him. And I don't know if it's – it seems like it's something that can be corrected. But it seems like it's so mental with him that it might not be.
Yeah, I don't know. Yeah, it's hard to say at this point. I mean, obviously time will tell what happens with Pettis. He's still, you know, obviously a young guy. But, you know, we've seen it happen where guys go through a loss like he did against RDA and never recover. And, you know, you obviously hope that's not the case, but it very well could be.
I thought Robert Whittaker looked real good again. It wasn't a spectacular performance against Rafael Natal, but it was more than good enough and just continued progression for the Ultimate Fighter Smashes winner. He's looked very good at middleweight. I thought this was a continuation of that. Again, nothing spectacular, but definitely impressive work to get yet another win at 185 pounds.
Yeah, I have very little memory of this fight other than the head kick that he landed towards the end of the third round. Mm. Yes.
Speaking of head kicks, thank you for that segue.
Nice.
Yair Rodriguez might have notched the knockout of the year. This was a... what was that? Almost a flying double kick where the first kick didn't land, but the second one hit Andre Feely right across the jaw and sent him down. Rodriguez was winning this fight regardless. He was doing really well in the first round, really well in the second. He has been a pleasantly surprising success out of the Ultimate Fighter Latin America because the competition on that was not good, but he has been a bright spot from that that first season. He looked very good against Charles Rosa. He looked just as good, if not better, against Dan Hooker last October. And this was as good as he's looked in the octagon yet. 7-1 now. Rodriguez just 23 years old and getting better. There's a lot to like about Yair Rodriguez, and this was a big step up over a talented and entertaining fighter in Andre Feely.
Yeah, there's a ton to like about this guy. This was a coming out party for him. Andre Feely is a dangerous guy, violent guy. When he has violent tendencies, but Yair Rodriguez, I don't want to say he dominated the entire fight, but he was definitely winning. And that kick, my gosh, that was a thing of beauty.
Yeah.
So this is something where if you saw this fight, you can't wait to see this guy next time.
The Fox Sports 1 prelims saw four decisions as Sergio Pettis defeated Chris Kaleidis. Danny Roberts beat Dominique Steele. Carla Esparza returned with a win over Juliana Lima. And James Vick beat Glyco Franca. On UFC Fight Pass, Walt Harris stopped Cody East at the end of the first round. Marcos Rogério de Lima submitted Clint Hester at the end of the first round. And Kevin Lee bounced back from his loss to Leonardo Santos with a decision win over Efrain Escudero. Any thoughts on the prelims, Sean, before we move on?
No, not really. Not a whole lot standing out there. James Vick looked pretty good. Cody East didn't bring a whole lot to the table there, I didn't think. Kind of a heavyweight slugfest. Walt Harris, nice to see him get off the schneid, but that's pretty much it.
Fair enough. As we mentioned, John Jones, Daniel Cormier is the new main event at UFC 200. That was announced officially this week. Cormier Jones tops the card, which also features Jose Aldo, Frankie Edgar, and Misha Tate, Amanda Nunes. So three title fights atop the event. Cain Velasquez also fights Travis Brown, Johnny Hendricks against Kelvin Gastelum, Gegard Mousasi against Derek Brunson, Diego Sanchez against Joe Lauzon, Sage Northcutt against Enrique Marin, Takanori Gomi against Jim Miller, and Kat Zingano against Juliana Pena. And according to Dana White, they are not done adding to it yet. So still options out there, but obviously the big difference this card has from the last 2 weeks is the fact that Conor McGregor is not on it. And with Jon Jones, Daniel Cormier made available, McGregor overplayed his hand a little bit in trying to get any concessions made to him. I still think the UFC is being overly stubborn regarding the demands for a little less promotion and not having two 13-hour flights in a week, regardless of the fact that it was several months out from the event. I don't think McGregor was being entirely unreasonable, and I think he had gotten himself some clout. At the same time, the UFC giving him the Diaz fight in the first place was a concession.
Yeah.
Especially at 170 pounds.
At 170, yeah.
And in this situation, they're willing to take the financial hit and the pay-per-view buy hit because on some level, they're still going to have a Conor McGregor fight after that.
Yep.
So it UFC 200 itself takes a hit, but the next McGregor fight is still going to be huge. I think it probably winds up being Labor Day weekend against Edgar Aldo, whichever of them can win that fight and turn around quickly. And unless McGregor really stumps for New York, because he kind of belongs on that card. So I don't know I don't know what's going to happen with McGregor here, but obviously they're taking a pay-per-view buy hit. But Jones Cormier is the more relevant, necessary fight than is McGregor Diaz 2.
Yeah, that's the eternal struggle, isn't it? You know, the so-called sports versus entertainment struggle. And you know, obviously, I think competition won this round. You know, and I will say, you know, there is no difference between sports and entertainment because sports is entertainment. But anyway. That moving on from that, you know, I think long run this is it ends up being nothing because, like you said, Conor McGregor is going to fight again and it'll do a ton of buys then. It doesn't really matter whether it's 201 or 201, 200, 201, 202. You know, they're going to get buys. It's not as if they lost out on you know, Conor McGregor is as popular as he ever was, and it's not going to hurt. It's not going to hurt the UFC in the long run. You know, maybe 200 takes a bit of a hit. Actually, unquestionably, it takes a bit of a hit. But, you know, the UFC is not hurting. They can afford to lose Conor McGregor for one event, and it'll be fine.
I'll say this. Having Dana White be the attempted face of reason from the UFC's standpoint has not gone well. He's stumbled around questions and acts as if it's insane to even wonder why they wouldn't just put McGregor back on the card. It's not a dumb question to wonder why they wouldn't just put McGregor back on the card. McGregor wasn't being entirely unreasonable. A lot of this is a power struggle, and Dana has not handled questions well in the last week regarding this situation and seems to think that just because that he keeps saying something, it means that there are no more questions left about it. So, I did like John Kavanaugh's comment, McGregor's coach. Do you want to see his best performance or hear his best sound bites? I don't know that it was necessary to have him in Las Vegas for whatever they're doing because they couldn't start filming anything for Jones Cormier until this week anyway. And to say it's, you know, it's not fair, it's not right, because everyone else showed up. Well, McGregor's bringing in a lot more money than everyone else, and you've treated him unfairly compared to other fighters in the past. What's different now?
Yeah.
So there's...
The other side of it is, and you know, I don't think, if this thing is over promotion, which I only half buy, they should be paying the fighters to do the promotion anyway, you know. They just should.
Contractual terms are a reasonable amount of promotion as dictated.
Right.
I don't know that having him that forcing McGregor to fly 13 hours from his training camp in Iceland and back after a world tour which goes through Diaz's home city constitutes reasonable.
Yeah, that's definitely fair, you know. And like you said, it's not as if they haven't made capitulations for McGregor before, even just with this fight. So I'm not sure what makes this any different. And it's not as if, you know, McGregor not doing a press conference is going to make, you know, is going to end up hurting the buy rate of UFC 200. So
I think the most maddening thing for me is it's put me into a spot where I've almost been defending a fight that I vehemently disagreed with being booked in the first place, but it just seems like a nonsensical business move on some in some respects.
Yeah.
There's also the aspect of long term. They're showing that okay, even their top guy is not going to get one over on them. That's a power play that they have won.
Yep.
So. Yep. I mean, that's a sign to everyone else, and that's the other sad side on this, is you've had so many fighters coming out in favor of the UFC over McGregor, and this is the spot where you should be siding with Conor McGregor. You should be siding with your fellow fighter, especially those at the top. Like I think it was Rich commented on it on Twitter earlier with... It might have been someone else, but I thought it was Rich that commented on Misha Tate taking the UFC side. And this is less than a year from Dana White saying she should retire after she was complaining about having the title fight taken away from her.
Yeah.
It's or Cain Velasquez coming out in favor of the UFC and saying, you know, everyone's doing the promotion. Well, that's his teammates at AKA were fighting the video game rights just 6 years ago, 7 years ago, and we're told, well, everyone's doing it.
Yep.
It's nonsensical for the fighters to be taking the UFC side.
Yep. Almost, you know, other than trying to get brownie points, that's pretty much it.
I think it was Sean McCorkle on Twitter said, for all those fighters, kissing the UFC's ass in hopes that it'll help your next negotiation. It won't. So,
ain't that the truth?
Yeah. Well, that wasn't the only action of the weekend, UFC 197 into the UFC 200 conversation, as Benson Henderson made his Bellator debut on Friday night at Bellator 153 on Spike, taking on Andrei Koroshkov for the Bellator welterweight championship. And Benson Henderson got beat as badly as he's been beaten since his submission loss to Anthony Pettis. And even that wasn't really it was kind of a beating with those body kicks, but Andrei Koroshkov just picked Benson Henderson apart for most of five rounds. This was a coming out party for Andrei Koroshkov and kind of a condemnation of Brandon Thatch.
I did not see this fight. I saw the highlights, full disclosure, but Koroshkov is the guy whose name I now know.
Yeah, I mean, Koroshkov's previous claim to fame was the fact that he got demolished by Ben Askren. I think outstruck something like 248-1 in an absolute drubbing and losing his first shot at the welterweight championship. But I think he was 21 at the time. He's 25 now. He's gotten a lot better since then, and he is only going to continue to get better. Whereas this is a sign that Ben Henderson is not a natural welterweight. It's both. You know, it can be both. I've seen some people say that talking about Henderson being a too small for welterweight is somehow diminishing what Koreshkov did, and I don't think it is, because this is a guy in Henderson who did beat a very dangerous and talented welterweight in Brandon Thatch, but that win looks worse and worse the more Thatch fights and fails to live up to his previous hype.
Yep.
And that second fight with Jorge Masvidal was a lightweight fight where they didn't have to cut weight. So that doesn't count. This was the sign that Benson Henderson belongs at lightweight, and hopefully he returns there. That's where his strengths lie. Andre Koreshkov picked up his sixth straight win and moves on in Bellator's welterweight division. Benson Henderson belongs at lightweight, and this was kind of a crushing loss for him, given the expectations coming over after leaving the UFC.
So I missed that last part. What was it?
Henderson, it's a crushing loss for Henderson, given the expectations after leaving the UFC.
Yeah, it is. And, you know, I think it's more for the expectations that he would come in there and just do whatever he wanted. You know, I think he does still have a chance to be a big draw for Bellator, but really at lightweight. You know, like you said, this kind of puts one of the nails, maybe not the final nail in the coffin of Ben Henderson at welterweight, but you know, I do think that he still has plenty of future at lightweight if he chooses to do so.
Just a few minor things that we're going to touch on here to close out. Starting with the unfortunate news for 27-year-old Irish flyweight Patrick Paddy Holohan, the UFC five-fight UFC vet, was forced to retire this last week due to a rare blood condition that it's something that he's known about and he's kind of kept under wraps. So he's been fighting at a risk to his own health for some time, it seems. He hadn't even really shared the extent of the issue with his coach, John Kavanaugh. He's a teammate of Conor McGregor's. And so he had been competing in the UFC while dealing with this rare condition, which is, I think, something – I think he said it was a 1 in 5 million issue. And yeah, missing some aspect of his blood that made it dangerous for him to be fighting. And so doctors, once it was finally revealed, recommended that he not fight anymore. The UFC is obviously not going to book him when their doctors are saying that he should not be fighting. And so Paddy Holohan, 27 years old, after I believe 3-2 or 2-3 run in the UFC. I think it was 3-2. I can't remember. I know he lost his last appearance to Luis Smolka, but you know, he was entertaining for a time, and it's always unfortunate to see, especially young fighters, have something like this come up where their career is cut short due to nothing they can help.
Yeah, it's a shame. I mean, especially when it's something this rare, you know, something that just kind of, I mean, who would have thought that some kind of crazy blood disease would cause a fighter to have to retire at this age? It's too bad. It's a shame. Not too much else to say about it, really.
All right, let's touch on some of the fights that have been announced for some upcoming events, because we've had some additions to several of the cards coming this summer. So I'll just toss out a few of them there, get your reactions on the bookings themselves. First up, the UFC is going to be at least testing out a women's flyweight division. The first 125-pound women's fight will be Valerie Letourneau against Joanne Calderwood at UFC Fight Night 89 in Ottawa, the card that our own Sean Ennis will be covering on June 18th. Thoughts on that and dabbling in 125 and what that means given the UFC's landscape at strawweight and bantamweight right now?
It's hard for me to imagine the UFC adding another women's division at this point. It seems like the women's divisions to them are kind of an afterthought. Once you get past the top four or five fighters in each division. So I don't know if this signals that they are entertaining adding another division. I mean, these are really just two UFC fighters that are fighting in a different weight than they usually fight at. So I don't know. It's kind of weird to me. I mean, it's not like this is like a super fight where two people are meeting from different weight classes that are, you know, people just can't wait for this one to go down. So I don't know why you do this.
The real curious aspect to me is the fact that they haven't really added anyone to bantamweight in quite a while, and that's the division where there are fighters who didn't want to cut down to 115 who are more natural at 125 and are fighting without cutting at all. And that includes Misha Tate, who has said that she'd be willing to fight at 125 and who thinks 125 would be workable for her. So I'm wondering if this is the UFC planning for a future without Ronda Rousey, because that's the reason 135 was tapped in the first place. Or if they're going to be looking to bring in an influx of talent, because they can't go forward with 125 pounds as a division with the roster they currently have.
Yeah, that's kind of this is all question marks for me.
Yeah. Moving on, the UFC's International Fight Week. We'll have three events, July 7th, July 8th, July 9th. July 7th, headlined by Rafael Dos Anjos versus Eddie Alvarez on UFC Fight Pass for the UFC lightweight title. And just announced today, Joseph Duffy returning to action against Mitch Clark, who himself is returning after 15 months out of the cage. Thoughts on Dos Anjos Alvarez headlining UFC Fight Pass?
You know what? I like it. I think it's a smart move to build up Fight Pass, because who do you have getting Fight Pass? You've got the crazy people who want to see all the MMA, right? So I think this is a solid move to get your borderline crazy people. You know, this was not going to pull a big pay-per-view buy. So why not throw it on Fight Pass and see if you can get a bunch of new subscriptions? You know, I think it was a pretty solid move on the UFC's part. I think it was smart.
You know, I agree with you on that end. On the one hand, you also have the fact that it's a real, real massive loss of revenue for Rafael Dos Anjos from what he was facing at 196.
Yep, that is very true.
That aspect is unfortunate for him. But at the same time, they are trying to make Fight Pass a viable and must-have service. And they have to have fights like these on their own service if they're going to get people to tune in. These are the types of fights that, if they're not going to use it on Fox Sports 1, because ratings are where they are on FS1, they're good to very good at times. They're certainly better than they were at the outset. Outside of that debut, they've gotten better over the last couple of years on FS1, at least steadier. Fox is in and out depending on the type of fight, and this isn't the type of fight that's going to be a massive Fox draw either. So put it on Fight Pass, and you also have an option for UFC 200 should something fall out and they want to put that on there.
Yeah, absolutely. This is good all around.
Yeah. The next night, Joanna Jędrzejczyk puts the strawweight title on the line against Claudia Gadelha. Added this week, Jake Matthews against Stevie Ray. Cesar Mutanch stepping in to face Anthony Smith. We've also got Ross Pearson versus James Krause, Joachim Silva against Andrew Holbrook, and Li Jinglang against Anton Zafir. I don't expect that you've watched a second of the last 2 weeks of The Ultimate Fighter.
I saw one highlight on Twitter.
Okay. The elimination fights were actually pretty solid. The fight last night was entertaining. Honestly, last night was the most compelling episode of Tough that I've seen in years, both between the dynamic that we had between Jędrzejczyk and Gadelha, where Jędrzejczyk is equal parts straight national treasure badass and straight heel champion.
Yeah, I think that was the part I saw.
Oh, where she was getting in the face of Gadelha's boxing coach who doesn't speak English?
Yes.
Oh, man. Gadelha comes off as sympathetic at times, a little bit naive in others, a little bit emotional, and not necessarily ready for the calculated, very pointed tactics of Jędrzejczyk. And that's the thing is Gadelha knows what Jędrzejczyk's doing, but is still reacting to them.
Yes.
So it's if you're still having the reactions, she's going to keep doing it. And Jędrzejczyk knows exactly what she's doing at this moment with everything. So it's been a fun dynamic this week, and the storyline that they had with Team Syndicate teammates Khalil Rountree and Corey Hendricks, the first real-life teammates to both make it into the house and have to fight one another on The Ultimate Fighter, was a really intriguing storyline, especially they had the added aspect of Hendricks messed up his feet with kicking in his elimination round. So they were badly bruised, very clearly injured and nasty, and yet Jędrzejczyk picked him first to fight against her fighter. Well, this was one of those fights where both fighters had clear deficiencies. Hendricks, not a great striker. Rountree, very poor ground defense. And both came into play. Rountree landed a bunch of strikes and did a ton of damage. Hendricks survived, got a late takedown in the first round, and forced a tap with a rear naked choke. It was an entertaining episode of The Ultimate Fighter, which is more than I can say for most episodes of that show in the last several years. So far, I haven't felt like I've entirely wasted my time covering the show.
Well, hey, you know what? That's more than you can say for some of the past seasons.
That is accurate. we've run down UFC 200 in that lineup. Later that week, that next week, on a Wednesday in Sioux Falls, South Dakota, Tim Boach and Josh Salmon will fight. Scott Holtzman faces Cody Pfister. Kyle Noak against Kaito Nakamura. Ben Nguyen against Louis Smolka in one hell of a flyweight fight. And Devin Clark against Alex Nicholson. That is what is set so far for that FS1 event. Any thoughts on the July 13th card?
I'm a big fan of Josh Salmon, and it looks like he's going to get himself a showcase.
Yeah, I can't say enough good things about the Ben Nguyen Louis Smolka fight. Honestly,
that is going to be good stuff.
That's going to be fun.
Yeah.
UFC on Fox 20 is 10 days later from the United Center in Chicago, Illinois. Alex Oliveira, trying to bounce back from his loss to Donald Cerrone on short notice in February as he takes on James Muntasri. George Sullivan meets Hector Urbina. Ryan LaFlair fights Alexander Yakovlev. That's a pretty solid welterweight fight, even though it might not be that entertaining. Luis Henrique fights Dmitry Smolyakov. And Felice Herrig returns against Kylan Curran. Thoughts on how that Chicago show lines up, and what do you think the UFC could possibly put on Fox, given how much is happening earlier in the month?
I mean, I don't know.
Because right now, none of these fights seem like they belong on national television.
Oh, no. No, I mean, not card, let alone the main event. So I don't know. I don't know what they can do. Part of me wonders if they're willing to put Robbie Lawler on there. I don't know if they are. I don't know how big of a draw he is. Yeah, I doubt it. I don't know. I don't know what they would do because I can't imagine them putting unless you get Demetrius Johnson to fight again that soon. I don't know. I don't know what they're gonna do. It's interesting.
That would actually be a really good spot for Johnson Benavidez 3.
Yeah, you can make it happen. It's not like Johnson's hurt. You know, he didn't get hurt at all in this fight, so it's something that could happen.
Yeah, I think that's it for us this week, Sean.
All right.
There wasn't much else outside of the 197 and 200 talk. That's dominated the conversation in the last week is everything into 197 and everything that's come out of it since. So 200 is going to take a hit from a pay-per-view buy standpoint. You know, the first Jones Cormier fight did 800,000 buys at 182. They might get something similar with this, just given the fact that there are three title fights and that it's UFC 200. It's on their, first July pay-per-view spot, but they lost easy 500,000 to 600,000 pay-per-view buys by not having Conor McGregor on this card.
Yeah, more than likely.
So that's what we got for this week. Thank you everyone for listening in. For Sean Ennis, this is Jamie Pennick signing off.
Ryan here, and I have a question for you. What do you do when you win? Like, are you a fist pumper, a woohooer, a hand clapper, a high fiver? I kind of like the high five, but if you want to hone in on those winning moves, check out Chumba Casino. At ChumbaCasino.com, choose from hundreds of social casino style games for your chance to redeem serious cash prizes. There are new game releases weekly, plus free daily bonuses. So don't wait. Start having the most fun ever at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18+.